Why do you want to go by what he does, well, man?
He invented the name.
Fuck Tons of Muggles.
Fuck Tons of Muggles is my new rock band.
The chapter titles are so good.
Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone. Chapter 1. The Boy Who Lived.
It's a solid hook to say that, oh, there's this kid, he survived something that nobody else has ever survived, and that makes him incredibly special, and he's going to be the main character, just for a story that's like, okay, that makes sense. It's kind of cool, though, how that becomes central to the plot in a very cool way, not just like, oh, he was, because eventually when it comes down to like the prophecy and whatnot, it turns out that didn't really matter. It was just, I mean, it was all about choice anyway. And Harry was caught in this, as a baby, he was caught in this crossfire with everything that was going on with these characters that had been going on for a long time with Snape and Lily and Voldemort. And it ended up with him surviving this. It's cool that she begins the story with this premise that he is the boy who lived, and then that actually does carry over. It becomes an actual cool thing rather than just being like, oh yeah, he's special. He's, you know, like the second Pokemon movie, it was just like Ash was suddenly the one who is prophesized about out of nowhere. Rather than that happening, it's like, oh, he had a prophecy about him, which sort of, but maybe not about him, and that made this whole thing happen. And so, it's just cool that it makes sense, you know?
Yes. No, I agree completely, and I hadn't really thought to think about it in that way, but it is great that the story starts with the, you know, the first words you read are chapter one, the boy who lived, and the fact that he's the boy who lived is...
I'd make the argument that it's the most significant aspect of his life is the fact that he lived.
Yes. How old are the Dursleys in chapter one?
My presumption is that because Lily and Petunia were so close in age, I believe was Petunia a year older than her or something like that, in which case she would be about 22, or maybe she was a year younger, in which case that would make her 20.
I don't believe they ever say, but I get the impression from the Prince's Tale that she must have been a year older.
Are we then to presume that because she was so close in age with Lily and because Lily was only 21, that she married a much older man? Or is Vernon Dursley a, you know, 25-year-old big fat executive at a firm that makes grills, and that would be kind of a weird image because that's still pretty young for the man you imagine him to be.
I feel like it's fitting of Petunia's character to assume that he's 30 to 35. I could see that happening, that she wants to marry up into like the status in the class of this corporate dude.
This is something I'm probably going to be saying a lot, and I really don't have much basis for it other than intuition, but I suspect this is something that Rowling simply didn't think through all that well. She writes them as sort of adults, like mature people who are unsympathetic to the concerns of youth, almost. And that's not really something that comes across that much here, but she doesn't do very much to differentiate them in this chapter from them in any other chapter in this book, at least. So I have a feeling that she wasn't thinking too much about the relative ages of the Dursleys to the Potters and to Harry when she wrote this.
I also think she wasn't thinking about the relative ages of the Potters when she planned out her timeline and whatnot. To me, it's weird how McGonagall refers to them as, like, the Potters, Lily and James, oh my god, and she never says, like, they were so young. They were at Hogwarts like 3.5 years ago, taking their newts.
Considering all of the many mathematical inconsistencies, I feel like Rowling just kind of, that was an oversight by her on figuring out all the ages correctly, because, I mean, this is one of many examples of things that she just appeared to not quite think through all the way.
The more I thought about the Dursleys as being very young, the more I liked the idea. the more I thought it's like, it made them seem stupider.
Yeah.
They seem almost like cartoon characters in this chapter, and I think this goes back to something I sort of think about a lot is the way that the early books are influenced by Charles Dickens. I feel like Dickens has these kind of larger-than-life cartoon characters that the Dursleys are influenced by.
The Dursleys are certainly more caricature than anything realistic in the first couple books, at least.
But yeah,
and then
but
then you're saying that making them 21 is just makes them weird and comical on another level.
It makes them weird and comical, but it also kind of humanizes them and sort of makes them into foolish young people in a way that I find that weirdly humanizing.
The 80s are when yuppies were, or when that term was prevalent or something, right?
I guess, yeah.
They're British yuppies. What they are.
I don't know how germane that is to anything.
The age thing is weird. I wonder where that decision came along. Was it only because she wanted, I guess it might have just been because she wanted to make Sirius, Snape, and Lupin like 30, like they wanted to have them be in their 30s in the books, because that was just like their, that's just like a normal age or something. They didn't want them to be too old, so they didn't want it to be like the Potters died when they were like 35 and then Snape's like 50. And
I think the young parents thing makes sense anyway, just like a couple moves out and they have their first kid in there earlier in their 20s. That just fits, that makes sense. I feel like the Dursleys here is one of the few examples where like really doesn't hold a lot because they don't feel like 20, but I guess they could be.
I mean, just but with the Potters even, like, I mean, you don't get the indication with this chapter at least. Mm-hmm. I never thought about like, oh, they're like young parents or something, for at least until like the 7th book. I didn't think that. I don't know.
Miravera said too. Yeah. Like, I never got the impression that Harry was looking into the eyes of a 21-year-old girl. It was, you know, it yeah, sounded much more like a 30-year-old woman.
Exactly. That's it, just, yeah.
One thing that I'm kind of interested in when I read this book, the sort of tonal differences in the narration.
For example, if I may go off of that, on page 8, this sentence makes me, it's not that bad, but it's just like it's so out of character for me where it like makes me cringe in this weird way because it feels like it's not her good narration. It feels like it's like this BS first book narration. Page 8, how very wrong he was. Because it implies future knowledge of the narrator knowing everything that's going to happen, which is nowhere else in the books except a few slips in the first book. And they annoy the piss out of me.
Exactly. I came to that. That was one I picked out. Another one was, when Mr. and Mrs. Dursley woke up on the dull gray Tuesday our story starts, there was nothing about the cloudy sky outside to suggest that strange and mysterious things would soon to be happening all over the country.
The idea that the narrator knows the full extent of the story and is sort of recounting this epic tale to you was something that was only in the first book, and I feel like they were all very corny moments, and I'm very glad she moved her narrator to a more present-focused after that.
There might have been some points. I mean, I'm thinking of, like, the Riddle House, Spinner's End, the other minister, those sorts mm-hmm. of things where there might be points in those chapters where the tone shifts because
it switches to a different viewpoint, but it doesn't go into this corny sort of I'm telling you a story, so let me tell you about this dark and stormy night when right. it all began.
That's true.
She stays very far away from that. She only does that in the first book, and I think it's very corny, and I'm glad
the point of view in general, even in the first book, is usually Harry Potter's own third person limited perspective, where we only ever have his perspective on things. We're never told how Ron is feeling. We're told how Harry thinks Ron is feeling. And there are actually a couple points in the first book where she briefly shifts into a more bird's eye view of things. Why aren't they at school?
Who, Minerva and Dumbledore?
Yeah. What's going on at Hogwarts?
They're probably having, like, Christmas feast plus Halloween feast plus end of the year feast all together. Also, fireworks everywhere because a fucking war just ended. I mean, is anybody going to go to Transfiguration that day? I think McGonagall just assumes nobody's going to show up. So she's like, I can go to drive for a day. No big deal.
Obviously, but you'd expect like the senior faculty members to be at the feast.
Nah, she's like, everybody can have one unsupervised day after having all these years of fucking like duck and cover, jump under the desks and hold your wand above your head in case Voldemort attacks Hogwarts. Finally gets up the nerve to attack Dumbledore.
We assume that Hogwarts was open for this full first reign of Voldemort. Why did he not ever try to attack
it was
that first
implied,
time? Why was he
a couple places in the text, I think. In the 7th book, it was just like he was never tried to. He like, I guess he knew he couldn't take Hogwarts from Dumbledore, and then it wasn't until the 7th book when Dumbledore is gone that he finally tries to do that.
The only one he ever feared.
Regarding McGonagall leaving, why was she gone the whole day anyway? Why in the morning was she like, I'm going to go wait at Privet Drive and sit there the entire day? And how did she know at that point anyway? Like, the time scale of this makes no sense. And also, why Hagrid was involved at all? Think from Dumbledore's perspective. You need to get Harry. You need to put him with the Dursleys. You apparate. It's done. Instead, he tells Hagrid, who on this like big secret mission goes and tells McGonagall first, and then spends all day flying around England to do this, gets there that night 24-ish hours after the attack, and McGonagall spends the entire time waiting. It's very silly.
In the years 2005, 2006, 2007, lots of people had this idea in their heads about this lost day, just how it was very peculiar, the fact that Harry is basically lying in the rubble of his house where Voldemort was destroyed for nearly 24 hours, and talking about all the different possibilities of things that could have happened or what Dumbledore could have done that day. Blah, 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 when it turned out to be nothing at all, really.
That would have been extraordinarily clever had she worked that in, that something important happened during that day that Dumbledore was doing. That would have been... I wish she had.
There are some good points to be brought up about the lost day. I will say that.
I don't really care that much. Like, I feel like at this stage, I mean, it is kind of interesting to point out, okay, here's something that doesn't make sense, and here's something that she clearly hadn't thought through very well. But I think there's a sense in which the entire first book is sort of more fueled by whimsy than careful planning.
Right, for sure. There are, even in this chapter alone, there are several other things that make no sense in later context, but were just sort of neat ways to introduce us to, you know, the world is all magical and neat, and hey, here's this cool character. Like, that's the only reason I see for this lost day, is that, first of all, she wanted to put the Sirius Black plant, which I think was a cool move, even if it doesn't make sense.
Even if it's kind of, just by the way, ridiculously expositional dialogue when Hagrid says, "Young Sirius Black lent it to me." rather than being like, "Sirius, you know, fucking Sirius. We hang out with him all the time in the Order."
Right. Either way, I think it was a good thing that she did that. But then also, I think she just wanted to introduce Hagrid early on. She wanted him to be a strong figure in the book and wanted him to be present in the first chapter. I think that was the big excuse for why he was involved at all, is that she likes him and wanted him to be around and be important.
And he took Harry when he was a baby and he carried him after Voldemort. Had shot the Killingers at him, and then later on in the forest, he also picked up Harry and took him back to Hogwarts.
Right, exactly.
I may go back on this later, but I think this chapter, and especially like the latter half, is the best writing in book one.
It's
the best chapter of book one, in my opinion. I may go back on that later. I feel like the parts of it that don't make sense are sort of necessary to get it to that point, because I feel like it's the conversation between Dumbledore, McGonagall, and Hagrid that sold me on this world and sold me on this book. I don't really have a whole lot of affection for some of the faults in this book, but I feel like that is something that sort of, you know, it still really gets me.
What? What really gets you?
You know, how good this is from there. And then, you know, the rest of the book is kind of not as good. But I think the last chapter is pretty good, too.
I do remember my fourth grade teacher at the time, she started reading us the book, and she read the first chapter in class one day, and I, like, bolted home immediately and read the entire thing. I'm not even sure what it was, but I feel like this is the most entrancing first chapter of a series that, like, ever
hooked
me.
Same exact story with me.
I mean, I was extremely, yeah, I still have the images in my head of Dumbledore coming down the street and the cat who becomes McGonagall and whatnot from Also, I don't know about your guys' experience with this, but I realized today I was thinking about the first book and having it read to me, and I was thinking about how little I knew about it, and just how basically it's kind of amazing that just the way that, because the movies became such an epidemic, nobody would ever go into these books not knowing anything. Like, I don't know. I probably didn't even. I don't know about your. Yeah, you guys might have had the same experience, because we got to read it way back when. But like reading it in like 1998, I was like, I don't think I knew that he went to magic school. Like, I think I knew before I read the book that it was about wizards or about magic, and that it was about a kid who's magic. And then so like reading the first chapter, it's just like, that's kind of amazing that like I had no idea what the fuck was coming, and that I got to hear about Hagrid and Dumbledore and McGonagall standing outside Privet Drive. Having no idea, because yeah, anybody who reads it nowadays, they obviously know that it's like, they probably have seen at least one of the movies and know about like Harry, Ron, and Hermione and whatnot. And then she had her kid in Portugal in like 93 or something. Or is that true? Did she live in Portugal? Or am I just making that part up because the guy who she married was
no
Portuguese?
Idea. Run with it, I'll believe
or
you.
I don't even know if they got married.
Neil the Dentist was from Portugal? I did not know that.
No, Neil the Dentist, he's British. He's, or English, or whatever. I don't know the distinction.
Oh, the first husband.
I don't know if she even got married to that guy, though, or if she just married, or if she just had a kid with him. Scandalous, JK. Scandalous, JK! Anywho.
Well, we got that joke out of the way. Don't have to make that for the next again for the next 4 years.
I'm sure it'll happen.
One of the most near religious experiences of my life was I remember just lying in bed one night, about 2006, probably, just thinking about the fact that 15 years ago, this woman was just sitting in a train station and an idea occurred to her, and she was excited to write about it, and somehow that became this thing that literally millions of people have experienced this fictional world in this very tangible way. It's kind of astounding that that's possible for a person to do that, and also just, I mean, not even in like a, it's not like she's like noble or something for doing that. It's just like that's the most beautiful thing that actually happened, that somebody just had an idea and just went with it, and she had this joy directed toward this thing, and then she expressed it through her writing, and was able to spread that love through everybody else who got a chance to read it.
That was beautiful, man.